From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Isabel Sandoval wrote, directed, and stars in the new Netflix film Lingua Franca, an intimate portrait of an undocumented trans Filipina living in New York. The film could have turned out quite differently if Sandoval, making her first film following her own transition, hadn't stood her ground with an investor who wanted cliched scenes of physical violence.
Yeah, that potential investor whose credentials actually turned out to be quite questionable anyway, wanted to take it in that direction. I was like, no, I want to tell this story my way.
Doing it her way, Sandoval actually asked for a smaller budget so she could be in charge of her movie. She talks about the twists and turns that landed Lingua Franca on Netflix, from initial production troubles to a successful festival run to a deal with Ava DuVernay's distribution company. But first on the news banter, big shakeup at Netflix. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, big shakeup at Netflix. And as we all know, Netflix has made a mantra from the beginning of this culture where you are constantly subject to being thrown out the door. You know, their thing is, I think they say something like an adequate job is a fail or something. That's one of their slogans. They have a whole deck, a much talked about deck about laying out this culture. And this week, they certainly showed that they mean it. Cindy Holland, who has run Netflix television programming since they were sending discs out in little envelopes, I think, since before Netflix became Netflix, for 18 years, she has been at Netflix out. And Bella Bajaria, who had been running the television production arm at NBC Universal before coming to Netflix, mostly doing international, has been promoted to run the whole thing. And for people at Netflix, I can tell you, even though the culture is supposed to be the culture, this has been a tremendous shock.
Yeah, I mean, it's odd too, because this comes the week that Reed Hastings, the co-CEO of Netflix, released his book espousing his philosophy of management, which includes this keeper test, that if you wouldn't fight to keep someone, or there's someone else better out there, then you should give a big severance to your executive and then have them go on their way. And lo and behold, it's almost like a book promotion. The day that it comes out, big prominent executive gets shown the door.
Yeah, it's interesting to contrast it with NBC Universal, which had been Bella Bajaria's home before she went to Netflix. They reorganized this week, and Bonnie Hammer, who has been a very high-level television executive there for many, many, many years, was moved to vice chairman, which is what previously had been the job that Ron Meyer had. And Ron Meyer had his own scandal recently. We don't need to talk about that. But the point is, this is how Comcast and NBC Universal handled a transition by first giving Ron Meyer and now giving Bonnie Hammer this vice chairman role, which is a respectful role, but a bit of an emeritus role. It's not like a hands-on to the same, it's not running a division in the same way that Bonnie Hammer had been. Meanwhile, at Netflix, if you're Cindy Holland, there's no soft landing, you know, and she's made a ton of money. She definitely doesn't need, you know, necessarily any kind of nice package or anything or a production deal. But I don't know that they offered her one. In fact, I understand there was a town hall where Ted Sarandos, the other co-CEO of Netflix, sort of implied that it would have been ideal if Cindy Holland agreed to report to Bella Bajaria. But I don't think he probably had the nerve to even ask that of Cindy Holland. For people like, as I said, at Netflix, they'd seen her going back in history of this company, I was told, be a really calming presence when they had this Quickster debacle, and it was a real bad moment for Netflix. She's not a warm and fuzzy person, but I think she was seen very much as a leader. And it's interesting, I like to talk about how Netflix glacially moves more and more toward legacy Hollywood, in spite of being this digital interloper originally that was going to change the way business is done. And now I'll just note, their movie stuff is run by Scott Stuber, who used to be an executive and then a producer at Universal. And now Bella Bajaria is in charge of the television worldwide. And she comes from the old legacy world.
Yeah, I mean, a lot has been written about how Netflix has upended and disrupted Hollywood, but it has done so from within Hollywood. And many of the people that have been successful in the legacy content business are now at Netflix doing their thing there. So, you know, yes, Cindy Holland is a big loss, I think, for them. She's also, we should know, one of the most high profile, openly gay executives in Hollywood. And I think a lot of people internally at the company really looked up to her and throughout the industry. So, you know, if I'm HBO Max, if I'm Quibi, if I am one of these streaming services that has been struggling and trying to find their way, I would hire Cindy Holland immediately and just download her brain, because she knows exactly what has been working at Netflix, what hasn't been working, and can probably provide a lot of value to someone like Jason Kyler at HBO Max trying to figure out this space.
I will note, Bella Bajaria has been more associated with international shows that cost less money. And right now, of course, what's really driving this in part is that Netflix is absolutely focused on international. They've grown a pretty mature audience in the US. Their model is based on constant subscriber expansion, and overseas is a place to look for it. So Bella Bajaria is bringing in less expensive programming, international programming, and that makes sense from Netflix's point of view. Let me turn to the Academy. The Academy issued a set of guidelines. They will be doing this in a couple of years. They will require contenders for Best Picture to meet certain criteria in terms of inclusivity. And there are different categories. It can be that you hit the mark in terms of what's on screen or the subject matter, or you hit the mark with your internship and opportunities programs, or, you know, behind the scenes with your crew. They lay out a bunch of criteria. You know, this is something new for the Academy. They've certainly tried to diversify their membership and have movies be more inclusive that way. They tried making more picture nominees. That was another attempt that I don't think did so well. But this is the most kind of regulatory thing the Academy has done by far.
Absolutely. And this is a fundamental shift in the way that the Academy sees its mission. And that's important, because up until a couple years ago, the Academy was insisting, we are an arts organization. We are not in charge of policing Hollywood or telling people what to do. We honor the films that come out of Hollywood and the world, and we put a big spotlight on them. That was what their mission was. Now, they are moving increasingly into an advocacy organization for a specific cause, diversifying and making Hollywood more inclusive. And you can argue whether that's good or bad. I would argue that it's a good thing they are doing this, but they are absolutely entering new territory by telling the community, if you would like to be on the biggest platform that the industry has, which is the Best Picture Oscar, you have to adhere to these new standards. And yes, a lot of people have noted that they are not that onerous, that you can get around, you know, having an all-white cast if you fulfill other aspects and go after inclusivity behind the camera, or even in an internship program, or in your marketing and publicity departments. But it's a start, and it's something. And I think they've tried very hard to do this in a way that is not going to infringe on the content itself. You can still do a World War I movie with a British cast of all young white men, like 1917 was last year, as long as you adhere to other things that make you more inclusive.
You know, I'm sure some of the old school people some of them are already complaining and saying that this is an infringement. I don't know. I mean, to me, it doesn't seem like much else has worked. We've just had another study showing that inclusion on screen has not improved in 2019, and nothing else has worked. Maybe the Academy needs to step up, and maybe people actually need to take the idea seriously. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. In her new film, Lingua Franca, Isabel Sandoval plays Olivia, an undocumented Filipina immigrant working as a caregiver in Brooklyn. Olivia watches over Olga, an elderly Russian woman played by the late Lynn Cohen.
Can I help?
This is too much work.
It's just going to get easier once we get started.
But I'm tired for now.
I know, but your grandson Alex is coming back home today, and I'm sure he would want to see you. The whole family will be there at dinner. Imagine what Alex would think if he doesn't see you there.
Like Sandoval herself, Olivia, the character, is trans. Once Alex, played by Eamon Farron of Twin Peaks The Return, moves into his grandmother's apartment, Olivia must navigate a growing attraction to a handsome, cisgender man contending with addiction issues. While dealing with her anxiety about that, Olivia is in constant fear of deportation. While Donald Trump is never shown on screen, he and his policies figure prominently in the film, in news clips and in dialogue, as Olivia tries desperately to get a green card that will allow her to stay in the States. Before Lingua Franca, Sandoval made a couple of very low-budget films in the Philippines. With this latest project, she noticed something new. Now that she was working for the first time following her transition, there were people on the project who were trying to tell her what to do. I think that's fascinating that suddenly you were more bullyable. Is that what it was?
Yeah, for sure. And also, I think that's partly because I wore multiple hats in this one.
Yes.
You know, I was writer, director, one of the producers. I was the lead and also edited the film. And yeah, I think it was just easy for people to find an excuse to push back.
And because you were now, you had transitioned, and I mean, they would pick on a man less than a woman, you think?
Certainly. And also because I dared to put on these multiple hats. And literally my first film to be set in and produced in the U.S. with a mostly American crew and my first after transition as well.
So how did you manage that? Did you just dig in your heels and say, this is my film and we're going to have to do it this way?
That's pretty much what I did. I actually ended up, you know, letting go of one of the producers who was the one who tried making decisions without my back and, you know, wanted to fire the cinematographer that I already had and bring in someone else. And although it's not autobiographical, Lingua Franca is a very personal work for me, and to be able to accomplish and achieve the artistic vision that I had for the project, I really needed full autonomy. And that's why I reasoned, and that producer that I let go actually raised the budget of the film from like 500K to 1.5 million. And there were production items that were just not necessary for the kind of production that it is. And so I talked to my producers. I told them, listen, let's bring it back down to just under 500K. I wanted to strike a delicate balance between having the budget just be high enough so that people get paid and get paid decently for their time and their effort, but also small enough so that I don't have investors breathing down my neck and telling me to take the story in a certain direction so that it's more commercial or it's more mainstream. I just wanted, yeah, complete freedom.
I mean, that's not the Hollywood way, Isabel, if I may call you Isabel. You're supposed to ask for more all the time, but this is indie film.
Yeah. But I was also very much aware that this is already a niche film, you know, given the subject matter. It's not ever going to be an Avengers movie or a DC movie. It's about an undocumented Filipina trans woman. And, you know, those just do not scream like a top 10 box office weekend.
You're making what it feels in a way very old school, a true independent art house film. You know, how did you go about financing the film and giving up before you gave away the money?
I was lucky to have partnered with a producer. He's a Filipino immigrant as well, but he is a Tony and Grammy Award winning Broadway producer, Jet Tolentino, who is really responsible for bringing in a lot of the private equity that that financed Lingua Franca. We also got money from grants, like Tribeca Film Institute gave us money, the New York Foundation for the Arts, Frameline, because these institutions are, in fact, seeking out minority filmmakers and artists to support. And we raised about 5% of the budget through crowdfunding, Kickstarter.
Right. So you pull it together, you put many demands on yourself doing this film. And among them, you know, you're the star of the film, you're acting in the film. And another thing that I read that you talked about was the sex scene that is a very intimate sex scene and, you know, a big moment in the film. You decided to shoot it on the very first day of the shoot because you, I said you wanted to prove a point.
Yes. I'm that kind of person. I feel like I'm such a daredevil sometimes. And whenever I feel like people think I cannot do something, I do it just to prove a point. And for the most part, it's worked out for me. And ultimately, like when I did that sex scene on the very first night of the shoot, I guess I didn't realize what I was getting myself into until the moment I was actually doing it, because I've never done a sex scene before. I mean, God, this is the second time I've ever acted in front of the camera, and the first after my transition, and to show, you know, to show something.
You show something?
Yes. I'm a very private person. So ultimately, I felt like that emotion, that ambivalence that I was feeling about shooting that scene actually worked for the character in the film. You know, I was feeling a little anxious and tense having done that over the next few days, which I still used because if I shot that love scene in the first night, on the second night, I shot Olivia's breakdown scene.
Yeah, which is also obviously very emotional. And you challenged yourself. I don't know if you were doing it to get it over with, or you just felt like, I'm going to attack.
I think also it's two things. One, to get that over with. And second, I feel like if I nail those two scenes, part of me thinks that I'll be getting more respect from the people that I'll be working with on set.
Right. How did you go about casting the rest of the film?
Bess Pfeiffer. That's how we got Lynn Cohen. The great Lynn Cohen.
Yes, and one of her last performances, yeah.
She was actually the first person that we made the offer to. And lucky for me, she accepted. When we met for lunch, she said she'd read the script and she loved it. And her parents were immigrants from Ukraine themselves. And she said at us that a story like Lingua Franca needed to be told and a voice like mine needed to be heard, which I really appreciated. Lynn, aside from being just a cast member, Lynn really was a champion of the project, and she became a friend of mine. We started meeting a year before we actually shot the movie, and we would meet for lunch every 2 months or so. The next person that we approached was Eamon Farron, who plays Alex in the film, and I saw him on Twin Peaks, The Return by David Lynch, and thought he was terrific in it. He played a villain.
Yes, he has that dark energy, for sure. You're expecting something bad to happen every second when you're watching it.
But he actually reminded me of a young Christopher Walken. And that Eamon is good looking, but he's not, you know, a bland pretty boy kind of way. There is...
Right.
He has an interesting character face, and I think he projects a certain vulnerability and unpredictability and erotic danger.
Yes. And did you have to do some exercises to get to a point of trust shooting an intense scene right out of the gate? How did you work through that part?
So we Skyped a year before we started shooting. We read a few scenes together. He was in London. I was in New York. We did not actually meet in person until a week before the movie started shooting. And
wow,
we did not rehearse the sex scene, but we did talk about it. And I think that the night we were going to shoot it, I pulled aside my assistant director and told him, okay, I don't want us to shoot a sex scene like the other movies do. I wanted the scene to be about her. And I asked him, how do I sidestep showing, you know, nudity but still selling the desire of the scene, just using my face for the most part. And
right.
So that's what we try to do.
Coming up after a short break, Sandoval talks about how Donald Trump's election influenced her in writing Lingua Franca and how her film got picked up by Ava DuVernay's distribution company. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmaker Isabel Sandoval, director, writer, and star of the film Lingua Franca, now streaming on Netflix. The film, which stars Sandoval as an undocumented trans caretaker, was in its early stages of development in November 2016, when Donald Trump was elected. At that point, what Sandoval had originally seen as a straightforward relationship drama began to take a different shape. The effect is clear in the movie. With bits of Trump's speeches playing on the radio, Sandoval's character lives in terror of ICE raids and deportation.
The writing process took a little over 2 years. Halfway after I started writing it, he got elected. Before that, the script was mostly a straightforward romantic drama where Alex is not aware that Olivia is trans initially. That was really the main and primary source of the dramatic conflict. But then after Trump got elected, I felt like I was plunged in an emotional / existential crisis. I was feeling really tense. I still remember the morning after he got elected. I went to bed as the Electoral College count was tipping in his favor, and I could not bring myself to watch till the end. The next morning, I was feeling shell-shocked and in such total denial that that could have happened. And I was in a state, emotional state like that for a few months, I think. And so that was when the final premise of Lingua Franca came together. And I really wanted to channel and tap my emotional state at that time, which then determined the mood and the atmosphere that I set in the film.
Yes, this macro anxiety dovetails with the anxiety within the relationship that is so powerful. And that's what your film, that it turned out weirdly that Donald Trump made this a more meaningful film, I think. I think you might agree. I don't know. Maybe not.
Certainly. And I also, but I did not want to show, you know, video footage or news footage of Trump. I just want to portray him and these forces of ICE deportation hovering around Olivia and closing in on her as the movie progresses, so that it feels more claustrophobic and more suffocating as a result.
You ran at a number of film festivals. When does Ava DuVernay get involved?
Ava got involved in early summer this year, officially, when they made the offer through her distribution company, Array. But back in October, actually, they had invited to screen the film at the opening of Ava's theater in historic Filipino town neighborhood of LA. But at that time, the film had not yet had its U.S. festival premiere. So we had to politely decline. We did eventually premiere at AFI Fest right there in L.A. in November, but we stayed in touch with Array until they officially made an offer to distribute the film in the summer. And of course, we said yes, and we're very thrilled.
Yes, this is her label that specifically is promoting all kinds of people who haven't been represented or worked in front of or behind the camera. And that is how the film ends up on Netflix via Ava?
Yes, I believe Array has a deal with Netflix. Mm-hmm. The films that they acquire stream in that platform.
You mentioned in another interview that you had turned down some funders because they wanted more violence in the film. Did that happen?
Yes, just because physical violence against trans women in relationships with cisgender men have become quite the trope in these types of films, actually. And they're usually directed and or written by cisgender men. And yeah, that potential investor whose credentials actually turned out to be quite questionable anyway, wanted to take it in that direction. I was like, no, yeah. I want to tell this story my way. And pardon me, on paper, Lingua Franca sounds like a standard, a textbook social issue drama. And I did that on purpose just to show people how differently or how I can deviate from that formula.
From the expectations, yes, that they would might automatically have of what that would be.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, you certainly stand your ground, so I don't think anybody will dispute that. And what about what now? What are you looking to do? I mean, this is a film that is getting some nice recognition. Do you have your next project in mind?
Yes, I'm actually a cable network is buying a TV series that I worked on. I'm working on, so I'm very excited about that. They're bringing me on as a writer, director, and one of the EPs on this TV series, and this is mind-blowing to me because I've never pitched a TV series before. So that was my first ever TV pitch, and they were the first place that we pitched to. And a week after our Zoom call with them, they told my EP that they're buying the project. So I'm thrilled about that.
Oh my goodness, congratulations.
Thank you. It's amazing. And during this pandemic, I also finished the script for my upcoming feature called Tropical Gothic.
That's ready to go, funded, or you're out looking now?
We are just starting to shop the film around, and it's even more wildly ambitious than Lingua Franca.
Well, you don't seem to be too shy about taking a dare or daring yourself. So you right out of the gate, you do something and it seems to go well, maybe not every time, but in a couple of important occasions recently.
Hmm? Yeah, I feel like I've always taken risks, even when I started as a filmmaker. My first feature was a big gamble. I've never been to film school before. And my first feature, I also wore multiple hats. And so far, I think because I was being true to myself and listening to my gut, that it ultimately worked out well for me. I did the same in my second feature and even more so in Lingua Franca. And my thinking is just that if it's worked out for me so far, you know, to keep taking risks and, you know, being ambitious that way, why should I stop now?
Isabel Sandoval is the director, writer, and star of Lingua Franca, now streaming on Netflix. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Kim. It's such a delight speaking with you.
And that's The Business. Kevin Tidmarsh produced and edited today's program with help from Kat Yore and Mario Diaz. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.